phone calls from a motel room in West Los Angeles, and I've even got someone paying me for my time, so it's nothing to me. It's fun if you really want to know the truth. I can get your service records, credit rating. I can find out if you've ever been arrested for anything, job history, library books overdue. Go right ahead. I got nothing to hide. Why put us through all that stuff? I said. I mean, I can go check you out, but I'll just come back around here tomorrow, and if you don't like me now, you ain't gonna like me any better then. I might be in a bad mood. Why don't you just loosen up? Oh, I'm real loose, he said. What happened to your plans to go to law school? I dropped out, he said sullenly. Maybe the dope smoking got to you, I suggested mildly. Maybe you can go get fucked, he snapped. Do I look like a lawyer to you? I lost interest, okay? That's no fucking crime. I'm not accusing you of anything. I just want to figure out what happened to Libby. He flipped the ash off the cigarette and dropped it, chunking it into the dirt with the toe of his boot. I sat down on a pile of bricks that had been covered with a tarp. Lyle glanced over at me through lowered lids. What makes you think I smoke dope anyway? He asked abruptly. I tapped my nose, letting him know I'd smelled it on him. Also, laying brick doesn't seem that interesting, I said. I figure if you're smart, you gotta do something to keep from going nuts. He looked at me, his body relaxing just a little bit. What makes you think I'm smart? I shrugged. You went with Libby Glass for 10 years. He thought about that for a while. I don't know anything, he said almost gruffly. You know more than I do at this point. He was beginning to relent, though his shoulders were still tense. He shook his head, going back to his work. He took the trowel and moved the damp mass of mortar around like cake icing that has gone all granular. She dumped me after she met that guy from up north, that attorney. Lawrence Fife? Yeah, I guess it was. She wouldn't tell me anything about him. At first it was business, something about some accounts. His law firm had just hooked up with the place she worked, and she had to get all this stuff on the computer, you know? Set up to run smoothly from month to month. It was all real complicated, calls going back and forth, things like that. He came down a few times, and she'd have drinks when they finished up, sometimes dinner. She fell in love, that's all I know. He took out a small metal brace at right angles and hammered it into the wooden siding on the house, placing a mortar-laden brick on top. What's that do? I asked out of curiosity. What? Oh, that keeps the brick wall from falling away from the rest, he said. I nodded, halfway tempted to try laying brick myself. And she broke up with you after that? I asked, getting back to the point. Pretty much. I'd see her now and again, but it was over, and I knew it. He was beginning to drop the tension in his tone, and he sounded more resigned than angry. Lyle buttered another brick with soft mortar and set it in place. The sun felt good on my back, and I settled on my elbows, leaning back on the tarp. "What's your theory?" I asked. He looked at me slyly. "Maybe she killed herself." "Suicide?" The thought hadn't even crossed my mind. "You asked. I'm just telling you what I thought at the time. She sure was hung up on him." "Yeah, but enough to kill herself when he died?" Who knows? He lifted one shoulder and let it drop. How did she find out about his death? Someone called her and told her about it. How do you know that? Because she called me up. At first she didn't know what to make of it. She was grieving for him? Tears? Shock? He seemed to think back. She was just real confused and upset. I went over there. She asked me to come, and then she changed her mind and said she didn't want to talk about it. She was shaky, couldn't concentrate. It kind of made me mad that she was jerking me around, so I left. Next thing I knew, she was dead. Who found her? The apartment manager where she lived. She didn't show up for work for 2 days and didn't call in, so her boss got worried and went over to her place. The manager tried peeping in the windows, but the drapes were shut. They knocked some, front and back, and finally got in with a passkey. She was lying on the bathroom floor in her robe. She'd been dead for 3 days. What about her bed? Had it been slept in?
I don't know. The police didn't give that out.
I thought about that for a minute. It sounded like she might have taken a capsule at night, just as Lawrence Fife had. It still seemed to me it might have been the same medication, some kind of antihistamine capsule in which someone had substituted oleander. Did she have allergies, Lyle? Was she complaining of a head cold or anything like that when you saw her last? He shrugged.
She might have, I guess. I don't remember anything like that. I saw her Thursday night. Wednesday or Thursday of that week when she heard that attorney was dead. She died on Saturday night late, they said. That much they put in the paper when it happened.
What about this attorney she was involved with? Do you know if he kept anything at her place? Toothbrush, razor, things like that? Maybe she took medication that was meant for him.
How do I know? He said testily. I don't stick my nose where it doesn't belong.
Did she have a girlfriend? Someone she might have confided in?
Maybe from work. I don't remember anyone in particular.
She didn't have girlfriends. I took out my notebook and jotted down the telephone number at my motel. This is where I can be reached. Will you give me a call if you think of anything else? He took the slip of paper and tucked it carelessly into the back pocket of his jeans.
What's in Las Vegas? He asked. How does that tie in?
I don't know yet. There may be a woman down there who can fill in some blanks. I'll be back through Los Angeles toward the end of the week. Maybe I'll look you up again.
Lyle had already tuned me out, tapping the next brick into place, troweling away the excess mortar that had drooled out between the cracks. I glanced at my watch. I still had time to check out the place where Libby Glass had worked. I didn't think Lyle was telling the whole truth, but I had no way to be sure. So I let it slide, for the time being, anyway.
Chapter 11. Haycraft and McNeese was located in the Avco Embassy building in Westwood, not far from my motel. I parked in an expensive lot adjacent to the Westwood Village mortuary and went into the entranceway near the Wells Fargo Bank, taking the elevator up. The office itself was just to the right as I got off. I pushed through a solid teak door lettered in brass. The interior was done with polished, uneven red tile flooring, mirrors floor-to-ceiling, and panels of raw gray wood hung here and there with clusters of dried corn. A receptionist sat behind a corral to my left. A placard reading, "Allison, Receptionist," sat on the corral post, the letters burned into the wood as though by some charred stick. I gave her my card.
"I wonder if I might talk to a senior accountant," I said. "I'm looking into the murder of a CPA who used to work here."
"Oh, yeah. I heard about her," Allison said. "Hang on."
She was in her 20s with long dark hair. She wore jeans and a string tie, her western-cut shirt looking like it had been stuffed with many handfuls of hay. Her belt buckle was shaped like a bucking mustang.
"What is this, a theme park or something?" I asked.
"Huh?"
I shook my head, not willing to pursue the point, and she clopped away in her high-heeled boots through some swinging doors. After a moment she returned.
"Mr. McNeese isn't in, but the man you probably want to talk to is Gary Steinberg, with two R's."
"B-E-R-R-G?"
"No, G-A-R-R-Y."
"Oh, I see. Excuse me."
"That's okay," she said. "Everybody makes that mistake."
"Would it be possible to see Mr. Steinberg, just briefly?"
"He's in New York this week," she said.
"How about Mr. Haycraft?"
"He's dead. I mean, you know, he's been dead for years," she said. "So, actually, now it's McNeese and McNeese, but nobody wants to have all the stationery changed. The other McNeese is in a meeting."
"Is there anybody else who might remember her?"
"I don't think so. I'm sorry."
She handed me my card. I turned it over and jotted down my motel number and my answering service up in Santa Teresa. "Could you give this to Gary Steinberg when he gets back? I'd really appreciate a call. He can make it collect if I'm not at the motel here."
"Sure," she said.
She sat down, and I could have sworn she eased the card straight into the trash. I watched her for a moment, and she smiled at me sheepishly.
Maybe you could just leave that on his desk with a note, I suggested.
She leaned over slightly and came up again, card in hand. She speared it on a vicious-looking metal spike near the phone. I looked at her some more. She took the card off the spike and got up.
I'll just put this on his desk, she said, and clopped off again.
Good plan, I said. I went back to the motel and made some phone calls. Ruth, in Charlie Scorsone's office, said he was still out of town, but she gave me the number of his hotel in Denver. I called, but he wasn't in, so I left my number at the message desk. I called Nikki and brought her up to date, and then I checked with my answering service. There were no messages. I put on my jogging clothes and drove down to the beach to run. Things did not seem to be falling into place very fast. So far, I felt like I had a lap full of confetti, and the notion of piecing it all together to make a picture seemed very remote indeed. Time had shredded the facts like a big machine, leaving only slender paper threads with which to reconstruct reality. I felt clumsy and irritable, and I needed to blow off steam. I parked near the Santa Monica Pier and jogged south along the promenade, a stretch of asphalt walk that parallels the beach. I trotted past the old men bent over their chess games, past thin black boys roller skating with incredible grace, boogieing to the secret music of their padded headphones, past guitar players, dopers and loiterers whose eyes followed me with scorn. This stretch of pavement is the last remnant of the 60s drug culture. The barefoot, sag-eyed, and scruffy young, some looking 37 now instead of 17, still mystical and remote. A dog took up company with me, running along beside me, his tongue hanging out, eyes rolling up at me now and then happily. His coat was thick and bristly, the color of caramel corn, and his tail curled up like a party favor. He was one of those mutant breeds with a large head, short body, and little bitty short legs, but he seemed quite self-possessed. Together we trotted beyond the promenade, past Ozone, Dudley, Paloma, Sunset, Thornton, and Park. By the time we reached Wave Crest, he'd lost interest, veering off to participate in a game of frisbee out on the beach. The last I saw of him, he had made an incredible leap, catching a frisbee mid-flight, mouth turned up in a grin. I smiled back. He was one of the few dogs I'd met in years that I really liked. At Venice Boulevard, I turned back, running most of the way, and then slowing to a walk as I reached the pier again. The ocean breeze served as a damper to my body heat. I found myself winded, but not sweating much. My mouth felt dry, and my cheeks were aflame. It hadn't been a long run, but I'd pushed myself a little harder than I normally did, and my lungs were burning, liquid combustion in my chest. I run for the same reasons I learned to drive a car with a stick shift, and drink my coffee black, imagining that a day might come when some amazing emergency would require such a test. This run was for good measure, too, since I'd already decided to take a day off for good behavior. Too much virtue has a corrupting effect. I got back in my car when I'd cooled down, and I drove east on Wilshire, back to my motel. As I unlocked the door to my room, the phone began to ring. It was my Las Vegas buddy with Sharon Napier's address. Fantastic, I said. I really appreciate this. Let me know how to get in touch when I get down there, and I'll pay you for your time. General delivery is fine. I never know where I'll be. You got it. How much?
$50. A discount. For you. She's strictly unlisted, and it wasn't easy.
Let me know when I can return the service, I said, knowing full well that he would.
Oh, and Kinsey, he said. She's dealing blackjack at the Fremont, but she's also hustling some on the side, so I hear. I watched her operate last night. She's very sharp, but she's not fooling anyone.
Is she stepping on someone's toes?
Not quite, but she's coming close. You know, in this town, no one cares what you do as long as you don't cheat. She shouldn't call attention to herself.
Thanks for the information, I said.
For sure, he said, and hung up.
I showered and put on a pair of slacks and a shirt, and then went across the street and ate fried clams drowned in ketchup with an order of fries on the side. I got 2 cups of coffee to go and went back to my room. As soon as the door shut behind me, the phone began to ring. This time it was Charlie Scorsone.
"How's Denver?" I asked, as soon as he identified himself.
"Not bad. How's L.A.?"
"Fair. I'm driving up to Las Vegas tonight."
"Gambling fever?"
"Not a bit. I got a line on Sharon."
"Terrific. Tell her to pay me back my $600."
"Yeah, right, with interest. I'm trying to find out what she knows about a murder, and you want me to hassle her about a bad debt."
"I'll never have occasion to, that's for sure. When will you be back in Santa Teresa?"
"Maybe Saturday. When I come back through L.A. on Friday, I want to see some boxes that belong to Libby Glass. But I don't think it will take long. What makes you ask?"
"I want to buy you that drink," he said.
"I'm leaving Denver day after tomorrow, so I'll be in town before you will.
Will you call me when you get back?"
I hesitated ever so slightly.
"Okay."
"I mean, don't put yourself out, Milhone," he said wryly. I laughed. "I'll call, I swear."
"Great. See you then."
After I hung up, I could feel a silly smile linger on my face long after it should have. What was it about that man? Las Vegas is about 6 hours from L.A., and I decided I might as well hit the road. It was just after 7 o'clock and not dark yet, so I threw my things in the back seat of my car and told Arlette I'd be gone for a couple of days.
"You want me to refer calls or what?" she said.
"I'll call you when I get there and let you know how I can be reached," I said. I headed north on the San Diego Freeway, picking up the Ventura, which I followed east until it turned onto the Colorado Freeway, one of the few benign roads in the whole of the L.A. freeway system. The Colorado is broad and sparsely traveled, cutting across the northern boundary of metropolitan Los Angeles. It is possible to change lanes on the Colorado without having an anxiety attack, and the sturdy concrete divider that separates east and westbound traffic is a comforting assurance that cars will not wantonly drift over and crash into your vehicle head-on. From the Colorado, I dog-legged south, picking up the San Bernardino Freeway, taking 15 northeast on a long, irregular diagonal toward Las Vegas. With any luck, I could talk to Sharon Napier and then head south to the Salton Sea, where Greg Fife was living. I could complete the circuit with a swing up to Claremont on my way back for a brief chat with his sister Diane. At this point, I wasn't sure what the journey would net me, but I needed to complete the basics of my investigation, and Sharon Napier was bound to prove interesting. I like driving at night. I'm not a sightseer at heart, and in travels across the country, I'm never tempted by detours to scenic wonders. I'm not interested in 100-foot rocks shaped like crookneck squash. I'm not keen on staring down into gullies formed by rivers now defunct, and I do not marvel at great holes in the ground where meteors once fell to earth. Driving anywhere looks much the same to me. I stare at the concrete roadway. I watch the yellow line. I keep track of large trucks and passenger vehicles with little children asleep in the back seat, and I keep my foot pressed flat to the floor until I reach my destination. Chapter 12. By the time Las Vegas loomed up, twinkling on the horizon, it was well after midnight, and I felt stiff. I was anxious to avoid the Strip. I would have avoided the whole town if I could. I don't gamble, having no instincts for the sport and even less curiosity. Life in Las Vegas exactly suits my notion of some eventual life in cities under the sea. Day and night mean nothing. People ebb and surge aimlessly as though pulled by invisible thermal currents that are swift and disagreeably close. Everything is made of plaster of Paris, imitative, larger than life, profoundly impersonal. The whole town smells of $1.89 fried shrimp dinners. I found a motel near the airport on the outskirts of town. The Baghdad looked like a foreign legion post made of marzipan. The night manager was dressed in a gold satin vest and an orange satin shirt with full puffed sleeves. He wore a fez with a tassel. His breathing had a raspy quality that made me want to clear my throat.
"Are you an out-of-state married couple?" he asked, not looking up.
"No."
"There's $50 worth of coupons with a double if you're an out-of-state married couple. I'll put it down. Nobody checks." I gave him my credit card, which he ran off while I filled out the registration form. He gave me my key and a small paper cup full of nickels for the slot machines near the door. I left them on the counter. I parked in the space outside my door and left the car, taking a cab into town through the artificial daylight of Glitter Gulch. I paid the cabbie and took a moment to orient myself. There was a constant stream of traffic on East Fremont, the sidewalks crowded with tourists, hot yellow signs and flashing lights, the Mint, the Four Queens, illuminating a complete catalog of hustlers, pimps and prostitutes, pickpockets, corn-fed con artists from the Midwest who flock to Vegas with a conviction that the system can be beaten with sufficient cunning and industry. I went into the Fremont. I could smell the Chinese food from the coffee shop, and the odor of chicken chow mein mingled oddly with the perfumed jet trail left by a woman who passed me in a royal blue polyester print pantsuit that made her look like a piece of walking wallpaper. I watched idly as she began to feed quarters into a slot machine in the lobby. The blackjack tables were off to my left. I asked one of the pit bosses about Sharon Napier and was told she'd be in at 11 o'clock in the morning. I hadn't really expected to run into her that night, but I wanted to get a feel for the place. The casino hummed, the croupiers at the craps tables shoveling chips back and forth with a stick, like some kind of tabletop shuffleboard with rules of its own. I once made a tour of the Nevada Dice Company, watching with something close to reverence as the 60-pound cellulose nitrate slabs, an inch thick, were cured and cut into cubes, slightly bigger than the finished size, hardened, buffed, and drilled on all sides, a white resinous compound applied to the sunken dots with special brushes. The dice, in process, looked like tiny squares of cherry jello that might have been served up like some sort of locale dessert. I watched people place their bets. The pass line, the don't pass line, come, don't come, the field, the big six, and the big eight were mysteries of another kind, and I couldn't for the life of me penetrate the catechism of wins, losses, numbers being rattled out in a low chant of intense concentration and surprise. Over it all there hung a pale cloud of cigarette smoke, infused with the smell of spilled scotch. The darkened mirrors above the tables must have been scanned by countless pairs of eyes, restlessly raking the patrons below for telltale signs of chicanery. Nothing could escape notice. The atmosphere was that of a crowded Woolworth's at Christmas, where the throngs of frantic shoppers couldn't be trusted not to lift an item now and then. Even the employees might lie, cheat, and steal, and nothing could be left to chance. I felt a fleeting respect for the whole system of checks and balances that keeps so much money flowing freely and allows so little to slip back into the individual pockets from which it has been coaxed. A sudden feeling of exhaustion came over me. I walked back out to the street again and found a cab. The Middle Eastern decor of the Baghdad halted abruptly at the door to my room. The carpet was dark green cotton shag, the wallpaper lime green foil in a pattern of overlapping palms, flocked with small clumps that might have been dates or clusters of fruit bats. I locked the door, kicked off my shoes, and pulled down the chenille spread, crawling under the covers with relief. I put a quick call through to my answering service, and another to a groggy Arlette, leaving my latest location, with the number where I could be reached. I woke up at 10 o'clock a.m., feeling the first faint stages of a headache, as though I had a hangover in the making before I'd even had a drink. Vegas tends to affect me that way, some combination of tension and dread to which my body responds with all the symptoms of incipient flu. I took 2 Tylenols and showered for a long time, trying to wash away the roiling whisper of nausea. I felt like I'd eaten a pound of cold buttered popcorn and washed it down with bulk saccharin. I stepped out of my motel room, the light causing me to squint. The air, at least, was fresh, and there was, by day, the sense of a town subdued and shrunken, flattened out again to its true proportions. The desert stretched away behind the motel in a haze of pale gray, fading to mauve at the horizon. The wind was mild and dry, the promise of summer heat only hinted at in the distant shimmering sunlight
that sat on the desert floor in flat pools, evaporating on approach. Occasional patches of sagebrush, nearly silver with dust, broke up the long low lines of treeless wasteland fenced in by distant hills. I stopped off at the post office and left a $50 money order for my friend, and then I checked out the address he had given me. Sharon Napier lived in a two-story apartment complex on the far side of town. Salmon pink stucco eroding around the edges, as though animals had crept up in the night to gnaw the corners away. The roof was nearly flat, peppered with rocks, the iron railings sending streaks of rust down the sides of the building. The landscaping was rock and yucca and cactus plants. There were only 20 units, arranged around a kidney-shaped pool that was separated from the parking area by a dun-colored cinder-block wall. A couple of young kids were splashing about in the pool, and a middle-aged woman was standing in front of her apartment up on the landing, a grocery bag wedged between her hip and the door as she let herself in. A Chicano boy hosed down the walks. The buildings on either side of the complex were single-family dwellings. There was a vacant lot across the street and back. Sharon's apartment was on the ground floor. Her name was neatly embossed on the mailbox on a white plastic strip. Her drapes were drawn, but some of the hooks had come loose at the top, causing the lined fabric to bow inward and sag, forming a gap through which I could see a beige formica table and two beige upholstered plastic kitchen chairs. The telephone sat on one corner of the table, resting on a pile of papers. Beside it was a coffee cup with a waxy crescent of hot pink lipstick on the rim. A cigarette, also rimmed with pink, had been extinguished in the saucer. I glanced around. No one seemed to be paying any particular attention to me. I walked quickly through a passageway that connected the courtyard to the rear of the apartment building. Sharon's apartment number was marked on the rear door, too, and there were four other back doors at intervals, the rear entrances emptying into little rectangles surrounded by shoulder-high cinder-block walls, designed, I suspected, to create the illusion of small patios. The trash containers were lined up on the walkway outside the wall. Her kitchen curtains were drawn. I eased onto her little patio. She had arranged six geraniums in pots along the back step. There were two aluminum folding chairs stacked against the wall, a pile of old newspapers by the back door. There was a small window up on the right, and a larger window beyond that. I couldn't judge whether it might be her bedroom or her neighbor's. I looked out across the vacant lot, and then eased out of the patio, turning left along the walk, which opened out onto the street again. I got back in my car and headed for the Fremont. I felt as if I'd never left. The lady in royal blue was still pasted to the quarter slot machine, her hair sculpted into a glossy mahogany scrollwork on top of her head. The same crowd seemed to be pressed to the craps table, as though by magnetic force, the croupier pushing chips back and forth with his little stick as if it were a flat-bottomed broom and someone had made an expensive mess. Waitresses circulated with drinks, and a heavy-set man whom I guessed to be plain-clothes security wandered about trying to look like a tourist whose luck had gone bad. I could hear the sounds of a female vocalist in the carnival lounge, singing a slightly flat but lusty medley of Broadway show tunes. I caught a glimpse of her, emoting to a half-deserted room, her face a bright powder pink under the spotlight. Sharon Napier was not hard to find. She was tall, maybe 5'10" or better in her high-heeled shoes. She was the sort of woman you noticed from the ground up. Long, shapely legs looking slender in black mesh hose, a short black skirt flaring slightly at the tops of her thighs. She had narrow hips, a flat stomach, and her breasts were pushed together to form pronounced mounds. The bodice of her black outfit was tight and low-cut, her name stitched above her left breast. Her hair was an ashen blonde, pallid under the house lights, her eyes an eerie green, a luminous shade I guessed to be from tinted contact lenses. Her skin was pale and unblemished, the oval of her face as white as eggshell and as finely textured. Her lips were full and wide, the bright pink lipstick emphasizing their generous proportions. It was a mouth built for unnatural acts. Something about her demeanor promised cool improvisational sex for the right price, and it would not be cheap. She dealt cards mechanically, with remarkable speed. Three men were perched on stools ranged around the table where she worked. No one said a word. The communication was by the slightest lift of a hand, cards turned over or placed under substantial bets. A shoulder shrugged as the up card showed. Two down, one up. Flick, flick. One man scraped the edge of his up card against the surface of the table, asking for a hit. On the second round, one man turned up a blackjack, and she paid off $250 worth of chips. I could see his eyes take her in as she flicked the cards back, shuffling quickly, dealing out cards again. He was thin, with a narrow, balding head and a dark mustache, shirt sleeves rolled up, underarms stained with sweat. His gaze drifted down across her body and back up again to the immaculate face, cold and clean, the green eyes blazing. She paid no particular attention to him, but I had the feeling the two of them might do some private business later on. I retreated to another table, watching her from an easy distance. At 1:30, she took a break. Another dealer took her place, and she crossed the casino, heading toward the Fiesta Room, where she ordered a Coke and lit up a cigarette. I followed. "Are you Sharon Napier?" I asked. She looked up. Her eyes were rimmed with dark lashes, the green taking on an almost turquoise hue in the fluorescent light overhead. "I don't think we've met," she said. "I'm Kinsey Milhone," I said. "May I sit down?" She shrugged by way of consent. She took a compact out of her pocket and checked her eye makeup, removing a slight smudge of shadow from her upper lid. Her lashes were clearly false, but the effect was flashy, giving her eyes an exotic slant. She applied fresh lip gloss, using her little finger, which she dipped into a tiny pot of pink. "What can I do for you?" she asked, glancing up briefly from her compact mirror. "I'm looking into the death of Lawrence Fife." That stopped her. She paused, her whole body going still. If I'd been taking a picture, it would have been the perfect pose. A second passed, and she was in motion again. She snapped the compact shut and tucked it away, taking up her cigarette. She took a long drag, watching me all the while. She flicked an ash. "He was a real shitheel," she said brusquely, smoke wafting out with each word. "So I've heard," I said. "Did you work for him long?" She smiled. "Well, you've done your homework at any rate. I bet you even know the answer to that." "More or less," I said. "But there's lots I don't know. Want to fill me in?" "On what?" I shrugged. "What it was like to work for him? How you felt about his death?" "He was a prick to work for. I felt terrific about his death," she said. "I hated secretarial work, in case you haven't guessed." "This must suit you better," I said. "Look, I got nothing to discuss with you," she said flatly. "Who sent you up here anyway?" I took a flyer on that one. "Nikki." She seemed startled. "She's still in prison, isn't she?" I shook my head. "She's out." She took a moment to calculate, and then her manner became somewhat more gracious. "She's got bucks, right?" "She's not hurting, if that's what you mean." She stubbed out her cigarette, bending the live ember under and mashing it flat. "I'm off at 7. Why don't you come out to my place and we can chat?" "Anything you'd care to mention now?" "Not here," she said. She rattled out her address, and I dutifully jotted it down in my notebook. She glanced off to the left, and I thought at first she was lifting a hand to greet a friend. Her smile flashed and then faltered, and she glanced back at me with uncertainty, turning slightly so that my line of sight was blocked. I peered back over her shoulder automatically, but she distracted my attention, touching the back of my hand with a fingernail. I looked at her. She towered over me, her expression remote. That was the pit boss, end of my break. She told lies the way I do, with a certain breezy insolence that dares the listener to refute or contradict. "I'll see you at 7, then," I said. "Make it 7:45, she said easily. "I need time to unwind from work." I wrote out my name and the name of my motel, tearing a sheet from my notebook. She made a sharp crease and tucked the slip into her cigarette pack under the cellophane wrapper. She walked away without a backward glance, hips swaying gracefully. The mashed butt of her cigarette was still sending up a drift of smoke,
and my stomach emitted a little message of protest. I was tempted to hang around, just to keep an eye on her, but my hands were feeling clammy and I longed to lie down. I didn't feel good at all, and I was beginning to think that my flu symptoms might be more real than reactionary. The headache was creeping up again from the back of my neck. I walked out through the lobby. Fresh air helped some, but only momentarily. I drove back to the Baghdad and bought a 7-Up from the vending machine. I needed to eat, but I wasn't sure anything would stay down. It was early afternoon, and I didn't have to be anywhere until well after supper time. I put the Do Not Disturb sign on my door and crawled back into my unmade bed, pulling the covers around me tightly. My bones had begun to ache. It was a long time before I got warm.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
Chapter 13. The telephone rang with startling shrillness, and I awoke with a jolt. The room was dark. I had no idea what time it was, no idea what bed I was in. I groped for the phone, feeling flushed and hot, shoving the covers away from me as I propped myself up on one elbow. I flicked on the light, shading my eyes from the sudden harsh glare. Hello? Kinsey, this is Sharon. Did you forget about me? I looked at my watch. It was 8:30. Shit. God, I'm sorry, I said. I fell asleep. Will you be there for a while? I can be right over. All right, she said coolly, as though she had better plans. Oh, hang on. There's someone at my door. She put the phone down with a clack, and I pictured it resting on the hard formica surface of the tabletop. I listened idly, waiting for her to come back. I couldn't believe I'd overslept, and I was kicking myself for my stupidity. I heard the door open and her muffled exclamation of surprise. And then I heard a brief, nearly hollow report. I squinted, sitting up abruptly. I pressed my ear to the phone, pressing my hand over the receiver. What was going on? The receiver was picked up on her end. I expected to hear her voice, and I nearly spoke her name, but some impulse made me clamp my mouth shut. There was the sound of breathing in my ear, the sexless, hushed tones of someone slightly winded. There was a whispered, "Hello," that chilled me. I closed my eyes, willing myself to silence. An alarm had spread through my body in a rush that made my heart pound in my ears. There was a small, breathy chuckle, and then the line went dead. I slammed the phone down and reached for my shoes, grabbing my jacket as I left the room. The jolt of adrenaline had washed my body clean of pain. My hands were shaking, but at least I was in motion. I locked the door and went out to the car, my keys jingling as I tried to hit the ignition switch. I started the car and backed out rapidly, heading toward Sharon's apartment. I reached for the flashlight in my glove compartment, checking it. The light was strong. I drove, anxiety mounting. She was either playing games or dead, and I suspected I knew which. I pulled up across the street. The building showed no particular signs of activity. No one was moving about. There were no crowds gathered, no police cars parked at the street, no sirens wailing in approach. There were numerous cars parked in the slots, and the lights in the building had been turned on in almost every apartment that I could see. I reached around in the back seat, removing a pair of rubber gloves from my locked briefcase. My hand touched the short barrel of my little automatic, and I desperately longed to tuck that in my windbreaker pocket. I wasn't sure what I'd find in her apartment, wasn't sure who might be waiting for me, but the notion of being discovered there in possession of a loaded gun wouldn't do at all if she was dead. I left the gun where it was and got out, locking my car, tucking the keys into my jeans. I moved into the front courtyard. It was dark, but several outdoor spots were placed strategically along the walk, 6 more green and yellow spots shooting upward along the cactus plants. The effect was more gaudy than illuminating. Sharon's apartment was dark, and the gap in the drapes had been pulled tight. I tapped at the door. Sharon? I kept my voice low, scanning the front of the place for any signs of lights coming on. I pulled on the rubber gloves and tried the knob. Locked. I tapped again, repeating her name. There was no sound from inside. What was I going to do if someone was in there? I moved along the short stretch of walk that led around the building to the rear.
I could hear a stereo playing somewhere in one of the upstairs apartments. The small of my back ached, and my cheeks felt as hot as if I'd just gotten back from a run, though whether it was from flu or fear, I couldn't say. I moved quickly and silently along the rear walkway. Sharon's kitchen was the only one of the five that was dark. There was an outside bulb burning above each back door, casting a shallow but clear light onto each small patio. I tried the back door. Locked. I tapped on the glass. Sharon? I strained for sounds inside the apartment. All was quiet. I scanned the rear entrance. If she had an extra set of keys outside, they would be hidden someplace close. I glanced back at the small panes of glass in her back door. If all else failed, I could always break one out. I slid my fingers along the top of the door frame. Too narrow for keys. All the flower pots seemed straight, and a quick search revealed nothing tucked down in the dirt. There was no doormat. I lifted the pile of old newspapers, giving them a little riff, but no keys clattered out. The surrounding cinderblock patio wall was made of 1-foot-square decorative bricks, each design of sufficient intricacy to provide an ample, if not original, hiding place for a key. I hoped I wasn't going to have to check every single one. I glanced back at the small panes of glass, wondering if it might not be more to the point to pop one out with a padded fist. I looked down. There was a green plastic watering can and a trowel in one corner right up against the wall. I crouched, sliding my right hand into each of the decorative whorls of concrete. There was a key in one. I reached up and gave the bulb above her back door a quick twist to the left. The patio was immersed in shadow. I fitted the key into the knob lock and opened the door a crack. "Sharon," I whispered hoarsely. I was tempted to leave the apartment in darkness, but I had to know if I was alone. I held the flashlight like a club, groping to my right until I found a switch. The recessed light above the sink went on. I saw the switch to the overhead kitchen light on the opposite wall. I crossed the room and flipped it on, ducking down and out of sight. I hunkered, holding my breath, my back against the refrigerator. I listened intently. Nothing. I hoped like hell I wasn't making a colossal fool of myself. For all I knew, the sound I'd heard was the popping of a champagne cork, and Sharon was in the darkened bedroom performing illicit sexual acts with a little show dog and a whip. I peered into the living room. Sharon was sprawled out on the living room floor in a Kelly green velour robe. She was either dead or sound asleep, and I still didn't know who else might be in that apartment with me. I crossed to the living room in two steps and pressed myself up against the wall, waiting a moment before I peered back out into the darkened hallway. I couldn't see shit. I found a light switch just to my left and flipped it on. The hall was ablaze with light, and the portion of the bedroom I could see seemed unoccupied. I felt for the bedroom switch and flipped it on, peering around quickly. I guessed the open doorway off to my right was the bathroom. There was no indication that the place had been ransacked. The sliding closet doors were shut, and I didn't like that. From the bathroom there was a faint metallic sound. I froze. My heart gave a thud and a half, and I crouched. Me and my flashlight. I wished like hell I'd brought the gun. The little metallic squeak picked up again, assuming a rhythm that suddenly took on a familiar tone. I crept over to the door and flashed the light in. There was a goddamn little mouse going round and round in an exercise wheel. The cage sat on the bathroom counter. I flipped the light on. The bathroom was empty. I crossed to the closet doors and slid one open, half waiting to get my head bashed in. Both sides of the closet were empty of anything but clothing. I let out the long breath I'd been holding and then did a second quick search of the place. I made sure the back door was locked, pulling the kitchen curtains across the window above the sink. And then I went back to Sharon. I flipped on the lamp in the living room and knelt down beside her. She had a bullet hole at the base of her throat, looking like a little locket filled with raw flesh instead of a photograph. Blood had soaked into the carpet under her head, and it had darkened now to the color of uncooked chicken liver. There were small slivers of bone in her hair. I guessed that her spine had been shattered by the bullet on impact. Nice for her, no pain. She seemed to have been knocked straight back, arms flung out on either side of her body, her hips turned slightly. Her eyes were half open, the luminous green color looking sour now. Her blonde hair looked gray in death. If I'd gotten there when I was supposed to, she might not be dead, and I wanted to apologize for my bad manners, for the delay, for being sick, for being too late. I wanted to hold her hand and coax her back to life again. But there was no way, and I knew in a quick flash that if I'd been there on time, I might be dead myself. I ran my gaze around the room with care. The carpeting was a high-low matted with wear, so there were no shoe prints. I crossed to the front window and readjusted the drapes, making sure no crack appeared to afford a view from outside, now that the lights were turned on. I made a brief tour again, taking in details this time. The bed was unmade, the bathroom was littered with damp towels, dirty clothing bulged out of the hamper. An ashtray sat on the rim of the tub with several cigarette butts stubbed out, folded over and mashed flat in the manner I'd seen her use. The apartment was basically only those three rooms. Living room, with the dining table near the front windows, kitchen and bedroom. The furniture looked as if it had been ordered by the boxcar load, and I assumed that little of it was actually hers. Whatever the disorder on the premises, it seemed to be of her own making. Dishes in the sink, trash unemptied. I glanced down at the papers under the phone, a collection of past due notices and bills. Apparently her penchant for financial chaos hadn't changed since her days in Santa Teresa. I picked up the whole batch and shoved them into my jacket pocket. I could hear the little metallic squeak again, and I went back to the bathroom, staring down at that foolish little creature. He was small and brown with bright red eyes, patiently making his way around and around, going nowhere. "I'm sorry," I whispered, and tears stung my lips briefly. I shook my head. It was misplaced sentiment, and I knew it. His water bottle was full, but the plastic food dish was empty. I filled it with little green pellets, and then I went back to the phone and dialed the operator, asking for the Las Vegas police. Con Dolan's warning sounded dully in my memory. All I needed was the LVPD holding me for questioning. One of those gravelly, officious voices came on the line after two rings. "Oh, hello," I said. My voice had a tremor in it, and I had to clear my throat quickly. I heard some noise in my neighbor's apartment a little while ago, and now I can't seem to get her to answer my knock. I'm worried that she's hurt herself. Is there any way you could check that out?" He sounded irritated and bored, but he took down Sharon's address and said he'd send someone. I checked my watch. I'd been in the apartment less than 30 minutes, but it was time to get out of there. I didn't want the phone to ring. I didn't want somebody knocking at the door unexpectedly. I moved toward the back, turning out lights as I went, unconsciously listening for sounds of someone approaching. I didn't have a lot of time to spare. I glanced back at Sharon. I didn't like to leave her that way, but I couldn't see the point in waiting it out. I didn't want to be linked to her death, and I didn't want to hang around Las Vegas waiting for the coroner's inquest, and I certainly didn't want Con Dolan to find out I'd been here. Maybe the Mafia had killed her, or maybe some pimp, or maybe the man at the casino who'd looked at her with such hunger when she counted out his $250. Or maybe she knew something about Lawrence Fife that she wasn't supposed to tell. I moved past her. Her fingers were relaxed in death, looking graceful, each tipped with a long rose-polished nail. I caught my breath. She had taken the slip with my name and motel jotted on it and had tucked it into her cigarette pack. But where was it? I looked around quickly, heart racing. I didn't see it on the Formica tabletop, though there was a cigarette that had apparently burned down to nothing, leaving only a perfect column of ash. There was no cigarette pack on the arm of the couch, none on the counter. I checked the bathroom again, listening acutely for sounds of the police. I could have sworn I heard a siren some distance off, and I felt a ripple of alarm. Shit, I had to find that note. The bathroom trash was full of Kleenex and a soap wrapper, old cigarette butts. No cigarette pack on the bed table. None on the dresser top. I went back to the living room and looked down at her with distaste. There were two generous side pockets in the green velour robe. I gritted my teeth, feeling gingerly. The pack was on the right-hand side with maybe 6 cigarettes left. The sharply creased slip of paper bearing my name still visible under the cellophane. I tucked it hastily into my jacket. I turned out the remaining lights and slipped to the back door, opening it a crack. I could hear voices remarkably close. A garbage can lid clattered near the apartment to my right.
"You better tell the manager her light's burned out," a woman commented.
She sounded as if she was standing right next to me.
"Why don't you tell her?"
came the slightly annoyed reply.
"I don't think she's home. Her lights are off."
"Yes, she is. I just saw the lights on a minute ago."
"Sherman, they're off. The whole place is dark. She must have gone out the front," the woman said.
The wailing siren was very loud, its tone winding down like a phonograph. My heart was pounding so hard it was making my chest burn. I eased out onto the darkened patio, pausing to tuck the keys back into the little crevice behind the plastic watering can. I hoped like hell it wasn't my car keys I was hiding there. I slipped out of the patio, turning left, moving toward the street again. I had to force myself to walk casually past the patrol car that was now parked out front. I unlocked my car and got in, pushing the lock down hastily as though someone were in pursuit. I stripped off the rubber gloves. My head was aching fiercely, and I felt a flash of clammy sweat, bile rising up in my throat. I had to get out of there. I swallowed convulsively. The nausea welled up, and I fought an almost irresistible urge to heave. My hands were shaking so badly I could hardly get my car started, but I managed, finally, and pulled away from the curb with care. As I drove past the entranceway, I could see a uniformed patrolman move around to the back of Sharon's apartment, hand on the gun at his hip. It seemed somewhat theatrical for a simple domestic complaint, and I wondered with a chill if someone else had placed a call with a message more explicit than mine. Half a minute more and I'd have been trapped in that apartment with a lot of explaining to do. I didn't like that idea at all. I went back to the Baghdad and packed, cleaning the place of fingerprints. I felt as if I were running a low-grade fever. All I really wanted to do was roll up in a blanket and go back to sleep. Head throbbing, I went into the office. The manager's wife was there this time, looking like a Turkish harem girl, if the word girl applied. She was probably 65, with a finely wrinkled face, like something that had been left in the dryer too long. She wore a pale satin pillbox perched on her gray hair, veils draped provocatively over her ears. "I'll be on the road at 5 in the morning, and I thought I'd get my bill squared away tonight," I said. I gave her my room number, and she sorted through the upright file, coming up with my ledger card. I was feeling restless, anxious, and sick, and I wanted to be out on the road. Instead, I had to force myself brightly, casually, to deal with this woman who moved in slow motion.
"Where are you headed?"
she asked idly, toting up the charges on the adding machine. She made a mistake and had to do it all over again. "Reno," I said, lying automatically.
"Any luck?"
"What?"
"You win much?"
"Oh, yeah, I'm doing pretty good," I said. "I really surprised myself."
"Better than most folk," she remarked. "You won't be making any long-distance calls before you leave?"
She gave me a sharp look. I shook my head. "I'm going to hit the sack."
"You look like you could use some sleep," she said.
She filled out the credit card charge slip, which I signed, taking my copy. "I didn't use the $50 worth of coupons," I said. "You might as well have those back." She put the unused coupons in the drawer without a word. Within minutes, miraculously, I was out on Highway 93, heading southeast toward Boulder City, where I took 95 south. I got as far as Needles, and then I had to have relief. I found a cheap motel and checked in, crawled under the covers again, and slept for 10 hours straight. Even that far down in oblivion, I felt an awesome dread of what had been set in motion, and a pointless, aching sense of apology to Sharon Napier for whatever part I'd played in her death. Chapter 14. In the morning, I felt whole again. I ate a big breakfast in a little diner across the road from the motel, washed down bacon, scrambled eggs, and rye toast with fresh orange juice and 3 cups of coffee. I had the car filled up with gas, the oil checked, and then hit the road again. After Las Vegas, the desert drive was a pleasure. The land was spare, the colors subdued, a mild, very pale lavender overlaid with fine dust. The sky was a stark, cloudless blue. The mountain ridges looked like crushed velvet, wrinkled dark gray along the face.
There was something appealing about all that country unconquered yet, miles and miles of terrain without neon signs. The population was reduced to races of kangaroo rat and ground squirrel, the rocky canyons inhabited by kit fox and desert lynx. At 55 miles an hour, no wildlife was visible. But I had heard the cries of tree frogs even in my sleep, and I pictured now from my speeding car the clay and gravel washes filled with buff-colored lizards and millipedes, creatures whose adaptation to their environment include the husbanding of moisture and an aversion to hot sun. There are parasol ants in the desert that cut off leaves and carry them as sunshades over their backs, storing them later like beach umbrellas in the subterranean chambers where they live. The idea made me smile, and I kept my mind resolutely from the recollection of Sharon Napier's death. I found Greg Fife in a little gray humpbacked camper outside Dermid on the eastern shore of the Salton Sea. It had taken me a while to track him down. Gwen had said that he lived on his boat, but the boat had been pulled out of the water for paint and repair, and Greg was temporarily lodged in an aluminum trailer that looked like a roly-poly bug. The interior was compact, with a folding table hooked flat against the wall, a padded bench that became a single bed, a canvas chair that completely blocked passage to the sink, a chemical toilet, and a hot plate. He opened two bottles of beer, which he'd taken from a refrigerator the size of a cardboard box located under the sink. He offered me the padded bench, unfolding the small table between us. A single leg flopped down to give it support. I was effectively hemmed in and could only get comfortable by turning sideways. Greg took the canvas chair, tilting back so he could study me while I studied him. He looked a lot like Lawrence Fife. Lank, dark brown hair, a square-cut, smooth face that was clean-shaven, dark eyes, bold dark brows, square chin. He looked younger than 25, but his smile had the same touch of arrogance that I remembered from his father. He was darkly tanned, cheekbones tinted with sunburn. His shoulders were wide, his body lean, his feet bare. He wore a red cotton turtleneck and cut-offs that were ragged at the bottom, nearly ruffled with bleached threads. He took a sip of beer.
"You think I look like him?"
"Yes," I said. "Does that suit you?"
Greg shrugged. "Doesn't matter much at this point," he said. "We weren't any